Hi, I'm Susanna Clark, and welcome to our Leading for Business Excellence podcast. In this episode, I'm joined by Claire Miles. Claire's the CEO of Yell. She joined them 2.5 years ago with a remit to establish a turnaround strategy. And it's really interesting to hear her talk about her approach to that, her assessment of the organisation, and the steps that she went through to understand what needed to change in order to turn around their results. I particularly was fascinated by the conversation we had about the customer and that end-to-end customer experience and how to think about that and measure that in order to really understand what needs to change in order to deliver the best customer experience and business excellence for them. One of the challenges that Claire faced was joining 6 months before the pandemic hit. And in fact, she launched her strategy just a month before we went into our first lockdown in the UK. She talks about how she had to adapt that strategy in order to adjust the environment in which they found themselves in, and how in many ways that speeded things up for them because they had to make some very fast changes as a result of services that were no longer available to them. It's also interesting to hear her talk about the leveling of the hierarchy. So how the communications that she has established with that system have enabled her to really integrate much more closely with the people that work in Yell, to establish relationships with them, for them to be able to contact her in a way that they wouldn't have been able to do before. And actually that's one of the real benefits that the pandemic has created for her as a leader. I hope you enjoy this podcast and that you get as much out of it as I did. Thank you. So hi, Claire. Thank you so much for joining me today on our podcast, Leading for Business Excellence. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. It's going to be a great chat, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I wondered if we could just start off with you giving us a brief introduction to yourself, a summary of your career, how you've got here to date, as it were.
Yeah, of course. So if I go all the way back in time, I graduated from university as a maths graduate. I specialised weirdly in mathematical modelling, but that led me into an early career in insurance, actually. I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do with my maths qualifications, but when you've got a master's in mathematical modelling, doing complicated predictive models quite often can lead you towards insurance. So I started in very technical, very analytical roles in insurance and then retail financial services, but gradually kind of came out of the back office and into the front office and was selling actually analytical services to financial services businesses up and down the country as a consultant for a while, and then got, I guess, more firmly into banking and started running P&Ls for people like what was HFC Bank, then HSBC. And I ran credit card businesses for a while, if anyone can remember the wonderfully titled Marbles digital brand that was born just after Egg.
I remember Egg.
I ran the Marbles cards and loans business for a while. I was specialised in credit card portfolios and then decided that I wanted to kind of get out of financial services and work in other industries, which took me to a company called Centrica, which is the parent company of British Gas. And I did various roles at Centrica, running different divisions of that energy company for just about 10 years. And then 2.5 years ago, I left Centrica and joined Yell, which is where I am now. I'm the chief exec of Yell, which, of course, used to be the Yellow Pages back in the day. And I'm also a non-exec director on the board of Biffa, the well-known waste collection and recycling organisation in the UK. So yeah, got my hands full with a full-time job at Yell and then my part-time job at Biffa, and I chair the remuneration committee at Biffa as well, which is the job that no one ever wants on a board, but keeps me entertained.
So that maths has come back to bite you. Now you have to look at remuneration.
Yeah, that's right.
To that. Thank you. So you studied maths at university, but if I bumped into you when you were a teenager, did you have a dream? Were you going to be something completely different?
Well, quite weirdly, the strongest memory I have when I was a teenager was I wanted to be French. And I'm not entirely sure why. I think I thought it was very exotic, and I looked a bit French. And if you trace my maiden name back to its roots, I'm actually originally of French descendancy, and I loved speaking French, and I studied French all the way up to A-level. So weirdly wanted to be French. But actually what came with that was wanderlust, and I love traveling, and I had this idea that I could somehow be a diplomat in France, and it would be some glamorous, political but useful job that would allow me to live in Paris. And I think all of that was mainly because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I loved mathematics, and I wanted to study mathematics for as long as I possibly could, but I didn't want to be an accountant or a teacher, and I didn't really know where it would take me. Financial services was, you know, a really strong bet that in some way, shape or form, using maths, I would end up in financial services. And I didn't really want to go into the sort of the hardcore world of investment banking and trading and all of that kind of stuff. So retail financial services, which is where I spent the first 13, 14 years of my career in one way or another, was sort of a logical place for me to go.
And I think it's interesting when you were describing the sort of your career journey at the beginning and sort of starting back office, very analytical financial modeling, obviously using all those mathematical skills, and then moving into front office and sales. I think that's where your French diplomat skills come out for me.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one point in my career when I worked for General Electric, the financial services division of GE, GE Money, as it were. And I was actually potentially going to transfer into a different GE division, into GE Energy. And I almost took a job selling power stations to different or to different governments, right, which I think would have then definitely used those skills if I had them.
Yes. So, as you said, you became CEO of Yale 2.5 years ago now. So timing is everything, like many people, around 6 months before the pandemic started, which must have been an interesting time to change roles. I am very interested in, you know, it's quite a shift change from someone like Centrica to Yale in terms of the organization. You know, when you make that kind of change and you're the new CEO, where do you start in terms of understanding, for instance, in the context of business excellence, what's actually going on in the company to understand what you need to do and how you need to lead it?
Yeah, sure. And it was, on the face of it, it sounds very different. But when I was at Centrica across those 10 years, I had 4 or 5 quite different jobs. The last job I did at Centrica, I was running their division called Hive, which is their smart connected homes business, which is a really young part of the organization, created this century. 60% of the workforce was software developers. It was purely digital native, very data, very modern. And so the transition from that to Yale, which these days is a digital marketing company, was perhaps more obvious than it, on the face of it, sounds, going from British Gas to Yale. And I had some of those jobs at British Gas, which were the opposite of Hive, you know, huge businesses, 13,000 people, heavy industry, lots of engineers, heavily unionized, etc. So I ran very different businesses at Centrica, but the kind of, I left Centrica from Hive, and so moving to Yale wasn't that dissimilar. But it's a different environment. Yale is my first private equity job. I've previously always really worked at large PLC listed type organizations. So it is a different environment. People that own the company are different kinds of organizations looking for different results, and we get measured and rewarded differently. So it's certainly been a different challenge for me from a leadership perspective. And yes, timing was interesting. I took the job knowing that it was really a kind of a turnaround mandate. The company does go back to the Yellow Pages, which is 1966, and has been through 50 odd years of conversion from the Yellow Book through to being a successful digital marketing services company, but I knew coming in that it was declining, and my job was to set a strategy to return the business to growth, and that was never going to be enormously easy. And I spent my first 6 months getting to know the business and the culture and how it works and operates, and setting a strategy to get us up and running and return to growth. And I'd literally just had that strategy signed off, and we'd launched it, and I think it was 4 weeks later that the pandemic arrived. So yeah, it's been difficult. But in terms of what did I do to understand the business and to make my assessment and develop that strategy, I always kind of I try and use a similar type of framework wherever I go to form a view of the health of the organization, really, and look at different dynamics. I'll always first and foremost look at what I would call the license to operate for the organization. So what are the regulatory compliance, the kind of the environment that the business has to operate in? What are the restrictions and the rules, and how is the company performing against them? And are there any, you know, big red flags or huge risks around the company's license to operate in doing what it does? And I think that has got to be your first bill of health of, you know, have you got any regulator that's got a problem with what you're doing? Have you breached any rules? Have you got any security risks around data, all that kind of stuff? So I will always look at that space. Then I will look at brand and reputation, and how is the company perceived by all of its stakeholders, mm-hmm. in terms of the general public, customers, past employees, and get a sense of how is the company perceived and what are customers saying about the experience that they have with the organization. Then I'll look at operational excellence and productivity, and you can start to look at that with lots of ratios of how efficient the business is. But the trick there for me is really understanding the end-to-end system,
yeah.
of the business, and not looking at individual transactional parts of it. And one of the things that I was very lucky to learn a huge amount about when I was at Centrica actually was system thinking. And For a few years when I was there, I ran all of the customer operations of Centrica Downstream, and introduced systems thinking as a methodology for people to really measure true customer experience correctly. What's the end-to-end journey time of getting something done, rather than measuring the five steps in the process to get it done? And so, you know, I'll always then look at that before you then get to, is there a strategy? Is it understood? Is that strategy being delivered? Are milestones and targets being met? And then finally, people and capability. What are all the indicators around the organization in terms of engagement, absence, attrition? Are we able to recruit? What are the capability strengths and gaps for delivering the strategy? You know, if you've got a strategy that says we're going to be a leading digital organization, but you haven't got digital people in the business, then you've got a problem. So, and I did that when I came to Yale, was, you know, I undertook a process to do an assessment around that framework. And then that sort of shows you all the internal and external information that I think you need, as well as looking at the market, of course, to understand whether you've got a strategy that's going to work.
And out of interest, what you've described there, you know, it's a very logical set of steps that you go through, which is fantastic, because that helps people, you can understand the frame that you're then looking, or the lens that you're looking through. Is it something that you have historically repeated? Because obviously I asked you, you know, at the beginning, where'd you start? But what about that sort of continuous nature of reassessment, and how frequently would you do that?
Yeah, you definitely need to reassess, I think, all the time, and course correct for whether you're doing the right things, and do that at different levels. So we launched our strategy, as I said, just before the pandemic arrived. So February 2020, the pandemic arrived, and our business was quite badly affected because our customers are small businesses, lots of whom had to either close temporarily or close for good. So we lost a lot of customers, and our business shrank in size, and we had to course correct for that. And we had to restructure and downsize a lot of our areas, as well as doing what everybody else did, you know, working from home and all that sort of stuff. So that caused us to reflect on what we were doing and what we'd set off to do from a strategy perspective. But we managed to stick to the true north of the strategy and simply move things around in the order in which we were going to execute them. We pulled some things forward and we pushed some things back, and all the stuff that we had planned to do around simplifying our customer experience, making ourselves easier to deal with, being more digitally enabled, and frankly, more cost efficient, we pulled all of that stuff forward. And all the elements of our strategy, which were much more around innovation and market leading product development, we kind of pushed back. So we changed the order of what we were doing, but stuck to all the principles of our strategy. And that served us very well. So whilst unfortunately we lost a number of customers and a number of people through 2020, because we had to right size the organization, we massively accelerated some elements of our strategy. And then what we did in over the period September, October, November 2021, so more or less 18 months later, we did a complete strategy review and assessed ourselves in terms of how had we performed, what had we done versus what we said we would do, what had worked, what had we learnt. And then we did a review with the board at the end of November, and we've just refreshed the strategy and we're about to relaunch it literally in a couple of weeks' time for the start of our next financial year. So 18 months down the road, we did a review and we absolutely think we're still on the right track with some refinement. And, you know, with the advantage of learning and time having passed, we can now be much more specific about the next phases of the strategy. And we're relaunching it now. And you know, that's a pattern and a process that we will update every 12 to 18 months, I think, and, you know, through the duration of this strategy until we need a new one.
Yes. I think strategy is a really interesting. It's a subject that I'm fascinated by. And I thought the fact, obviously, as you say, timing is everything. You had a strategy that you just launched in February and then had that opportunity, as it were, to review that and make sure that it was going to be fit for purpose, given what you were facing. We talked to, obviously, many clients around that time. Some came forward and specifically asked to work on their strategy at that time with us. So sort of March, April, May, June, they were really focused because they believed, and now I would say rightly so, that actually they needed to really pay attention to that strategy in order to be able to have a confident plan, both for how they were going to get through the near term and then prosper in the future. Where there were other organizations who were understandably not necessarily linking it to their strategy and simply sort of focusing on, let's put this fire out as quickly as we can. And I get that too, because it was something that many of us weren't prepared for. But it was interesting to see those who stood up and said, actually, the strategy is the tool I'm going to use that's going to inform our choices and help us with our decisions.
And that's exactly what we did. I think it's kind of perverse to say this, but in some ways we were fortunate that when the pandemic arrived, we had a strategy which was to turn the business around and which required us to do a lot of things very differently and to fight for survival. And so what the pandemic meant for us was actually we just need to fight an awful lot harder and an awful lot quicker on a lot of the elements of the strategy we just laid down. So we were kind of we all had a very clear view of what we were going to execute over the next 3 years. We just chose to do some of those things in 3 months and some of them in 24 hours. We had the misfortune for all of our offshore services to disappear on us overnight. We had planned to do onshoring 18 months down the road, and we did it in 24 hours.
And these were people who were providing a service to you and just unable to supply anymore.
Yeah, the lights just went out because they had no capacity and no capability in both India and the Philippines for their people to work from home.
Right, yes.
And
yes.
Had to send them home. So we had no choice, really. So yeah, it was a very tough time, but we never went back. Because we knew that was the long-term plan and we just dealt with it. And ultimately, our customer experience on the other side of it was so much simpler. And please don't misunderstand, I have nothing against offshoring and I've used offshore partners for all of my career. But our journeys were too complicated and there were too many steps in the process. And what it enabled us to do was to upskill all of our customer service teams in the UK to just deal with customers right first time and not bounce them around loads of different departments, which happened to be in different locations. So it was very difficult, but we knew that was the right answer for us long term. We just had no idea we were going to do it that quickly.
Yes. I think speed has to be one of the most common things, you know, apart from, you know, can you hear me on a call or you're on mute. But the speed at which people have delivered change, huge transformational change, has been amazing to watch.
Yeah.
Often in that situation of adversity where the most unexpected happens, and even the best risk register in the world hasn't prepared you for that necessarily.
That's right. Yeah.
As you know, we're a systems thinking organization. I'm quite interested around the, you're talking about that, how systems thinking helps you to measure the customer experience. And I wondered if you could just talk a bit more about how you use it for that in that context.
Yeah, so I mentioned that it was when I was at Centrica that I really was introduced to the concept of systems thinking. And it was when I had a job that involved, in essence, taking the customer service and customer operations of lots of different product P&Ls and putting them together to create one coherent customer experience for customers, no matter which product they had, if that makes sense. Right. So yeah. Historical legacy of product P&Ls where each product had its own customer setup with its own standards and KPIs and service levels. And I had to kind of put that together and make sense of it. And so the concept of, and this was in the energy industry, so the concept of how long does it take for a customer from the minute they show an interest in getting a smart meter, for example, to the smart meter being in their house and they're no longer getting a paper bill and the money being automatically taken out of their bank account. Thinking about that as a system rather than the 27 steps in the process of customer gets an email, customer books an appointment, appointment goes into a planning and dispatch system, an engineer is scheduled, the engineer turns up, the engineer then has to go and get the parts, and then there's a second visit, and every single step in the process, you know, and moving from historically managing operational excellence as how quickly each one of those 27 steps was done to actually what is the end-to-end view of the customer? Because there were very real examples in that business of operational teams thinking they were doing a fantastic job, but customers waiting 6 months for the end-to-end experience to happen. And so what customers thought of the business was entirely different to what the internal teams thought they were delivering for the customer. And so wherever possible, I try to ensure that there's a step back of what is the customer outcome that we're trying to deliver here? What's the customer intent? And what is the customer outcome? And what's the end-to-end experience? And how do you measure that rather than each element in the process? And actually, how do you remove as many of those processes as possible, either through automation or frankly, because they're just not needed?
Yes.
And so, you know, that's a sort of a mindset and a philosophy that I just try and get people in the business to adopt. We haven't, I mean, Yell is it's a reasonably small business. We haven't set up any kind of philosophy or approach that we adopt across the organization. We're a very agile business. Everything that we do is agile, and we run everything in Scrum or Kanban teams. And so we're a very fast learning organization, and we do things very, very iteratively. But I think that it's about your mindset of how you build things and how you improve things. And it's got to be all about customer outcomes and customer impact.
Mm. And I think that is interesting. You're talking about agile. We were doing some work with really understanding the comparison with the client about some of the agile methods that they have and the link between what we would see as, you know, more lean type approaches and some of the stuff at the, you know, heart of our philosophy around PDSA and so on and so forth. And suddenly the penny was dropping with the client around Okay, so that's iterative as well, isn't it? It doesn't actually have to be separate. You can do both together. You know, yeah. So your background in systems thinking and process and operational excellence and so on is a, I would imagine, has been a great fit in that agile environment and the way that those groups are working. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I hope what I have brought to Yell is a significantly more data-driven approach to how we do everything. It's quite crazy to think, if you think about what kind of an organization we are, it's a business that's based on consumers searching for businesses, and we have got so much data, it's ridiculous. You know, we've got all the search data of what all the consumers in Britain search for when they're looking for a local business to do something for them, and we're sat on mountains of data. But getting the organization to be fully data enabled is a huge culture shift. But now, since we have moved into fully an agile environment, all of our scrum teams are just, you know, it's just habitual now that everything gets measured and we've got tracking on everything. And, you know, all the end-to-end processes, funnels, steps and journeys, they're just monitoring those dashboards all the time and seeing small movements and then doubling down on things that do work and moving away from things that don't work is just now becoming more and more the fabric of the organization, which is great to see.
Yeah, and feels quite liberating, as you know, from that position of, I have this vision of all these people looking at the data and saying, ooh, I can do something better now that I know that. I remember talking to somebody recently who was saying about wanting to see a shift change, that people came to work to improve their work rather than do their work. And it's a different, you come from a different place when you think like that, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a sort of, there's a courage about it. And courage is one of the values that we have at Yell. And at the same time as when we launched the strategy in February 2020, we updated it, our value set as well. And courage is one of them quite deliberately, because we need courage, frankly, to make the Yell business great again. But I want all the employees inside Yell to have courage to stand up for what's right, to call out what's wrong, and to have the courage to belief that, you know, to try things. And when we launch new products and MVPs of new digital development, just putting it out there and knowing that it may or it may not work, and actually what we're doing is gathering data to understand where it does work and for which businesses does it work and in which sectors, in which part of the country. And we still do have those debates around, are we quite sure, and don't we just want to pilot that and let's do it in a really narrow way in Wales, or, you know, for plumbers in Wales. And, you know, and we're slowly coming to terms with, actually, no, we're just going to put it out there and see who likes it, and we'll fail fast and learn quick and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that is culturally very different to where the organization has been in the past.
Yes, yes. The number of other podcasts, not that I want to promote other people's podcasts, but I've been listening to podcasts on how to fail, which I inherently find really interesting. And that sense of, it is how you learn, it is actually how you get better. I remember saying to my children when we used to go skiing and they were little and they fall over, I said, you know, just, it shows you're trying. Yeah. Yeah. When you fall, no, it's fine. You know, the thing is, don't give up, get up, have another go. And being able to work in an environment where it's okay to fail, because it does show that you are pushing boundaries to create something better, is important. Most people are, I think, just brought up to believe that failure's not an option around here.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully that is changing a little bit. And, you know, what we are trying to do specifically at Yell with the Yell marketplace that we are building at the moment, if it had been easy, it would have been done a long time ago. So I'm just not surprised that as we update all of the features and functionality and we build new technology and we use AI to build significantly better, deeper, richer experiences for consumers and businesses, I'm not surprised that it feels like one step forward, two steps back sometimes, because if it was easy, like I say, someone would have done this a long time ago.
Yes. And in terms of you as CEO, how you know, we talked about the work that you did with your strategy and the reorganization as the pandemic's gone. How have you managed to ensure, for instance, that the whole organization gets where you're going, the whole organization is now working in this way?
Yeah, so I think I've heard a lot of leaders say this actually, but one of the sort of blessings of the pandemic has been that working from home has been a great leveler. And, you know, I think business has become a lot less formal, and the way that leaders can communicate with employees has changed out of all recognition. And I'm not alone in this, that I suddenly went from, well, I'll get on a train and go to Birmingham and I'll stand up in front of a contact centre once a quarter and take them off the phones and do this physical kind of briefing, if you like, to getting everybody on Teams and talking to them every day live in their lounge. That regularity, frequency, informality, openness, constant communication that was just became part and parcel of leading a business through a pandemic was actually a blessing. And I think really, really helped connect leaders to the business. And I've just kept that going. You know, I religiously do my regular business updates to the organization. I'm doing them fortnightly now. I literally record them on my little iPad in my office and push them out to the whole business. And then I do intersperse them with live ones. We did a live event today, in fact, with the whole organization. And it has really helped, just constantly positive feedback about that. I'm a very honest and open person, and just folks just feel much closer to what's going on. And I communicate regularly, but honestly, about how we're doing and all different elements of the strategy. So it's not just news, you know, it is an appraisal of how we're doing and the ups and the downs. But I'm very open, you know. Like I said, the organization's not that huge. There's 1,100 of us, and anyone can ask me a question anytime. And I've got, I don't know how many open chats on Teams, chatting to people right across the organization. And I think folk understand that I am there and they can do that. So it's really changed the dynamic of leadership communication for the better, I think. Yes. And I enjoy it. It's so much nicer than running a conference. Yeah. Which are great as well. Don't get me wrong, they're great. And actually, we've got an in-person conference coming up for the first time in 2 years for our managers. But constant communication, talking at a level where you feel literally at the same level as someone because you both sat in your home, I think has made a massive difference to being able to bring an organization with you.
Yeah, no, I can totally appreciate that. I think that you're absolutely right around the leveling. That I can see how it is obviously a shift change, but also it creates the contact that would previously perhaps not have been possible. People who are quite happy to reach out to you on Teams and send you a message, who previously it wouldn't have occurred to them that they could do that.
Correct.
Presumably.
Yeah, absolutely.
The hierarchy sits there and it's just not the done thing. You go through your hierarchy almost.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, people used to see me in the corner of a building in a glass office and wouldn't think that they could walk up and knock on the door and come in, I don't think. I wouldn't have minded. You know, the environment sets the tone, doesn't it? Whereas Teams has just changed that, or Zoom, whatever you're on, has changed it completely.
Yes. And then that whole thing about we're in this together, is there something about that too? Because we were all going through the same challenges. You know, the fear, obviously, of what it meant from a health perspective, our families, you know, some degree of isolation, parents, homeschooling children, and that just completely changes the sense of empathy between each other and understanding.
Yes, it really does. Yeah, and I mean, my organisation have watched me dealing with homeschooling. It wasn't good. And dogs running around and, yeah, everything, you know, panicking about not being able to get food to my elderly mother. And you're right. Everyone is suddenly very humanized by the same experience of a common enemy. And I think we're all better off for it, to be honest. I think you become much more authentic as a leader on the other side of that.
I think closing that gap between everybody in the organization and the leadership team, you know, can only be a wonderful thing, can't it?
Yeah.
Really good. So through the course of your career, who would you say has been a significant influence on you, you know, as a leader?
Yeah, great question. I'm very fortunate to have worked for some great people. At Centrica, I was there for 10 years and I worked for some great people there. I was actually out for dinner with a couple of them last week, bizarrely. First time I've seen them post-pandemic. I won't name check them, but a couple of the guys, and there were guys that I worked for at Centrica, were just phenomenal to work for, and phenomenal because of how they supported me. You know, they believed in me, they listened to me. Yes, they challenged and poked and tried to get me to do more and to do better, but really let me find my own way and take my own risks, and supported me in doing that, and celebrated when it went well, but supported me when it didn't, sort of harsh but fair, but also at the end of the day, just really had a laugh about it, made work fun, no matter how difficult and how pressurized it was. We always had a really good laugh at the end of the day, and you felt like, to use your words, you felt like you were in it together. Yes. And those two, the two guys that I'm thinking of in particular, I will name check them, Mark Hodges and Matthew Bateman, you know, they'll be friends for life, for sure. And it was a fantastic experience to work with them. When you can look back on what were at the time unbelievably difficult periods of work, but you can look back on it with humour, mm-hmm. and with good friendship, that is a really good feeling. And, you know, I do feel that Yell will be the same. I'm very, very lucky to have the team that I do at Yell. They're a great bunch of people and they are so in it together, just yes. genuinely supportive and collaborative and help and support each other every day. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, we do a lot of work, don't we? So we've got to feel good about it, and we've got to feel good about the people we work with, you know, to keep right. wanting to go back, haven't you?
Yeah.
So out of interest, what would you say is the best quality or customer service experience that you've ever had personally? And I ask this because you've talked a lot about that customer, particularly around that understanding the customer experience. So I just wondered whether you have got something where you hold that up high as that's what we aspire to achieve.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of lots of terrible customer experiences that I've had. There is a day that springs to mind that's relatively recent, actually, and it's a kind of a good story and a bad story. Just before Christmas, I went to Edinburgh for a few days, and I actually flew to Edinburgh and back to Heathrow. And on my return flight from Edinburgh back to Heathrow, which most people will know is about a 55-minute flight, there were quite a few problems weather-wise with fog. And I left Edinburgh, my hotel in Edinburgh, at 9 o'clock Sunday morning, and I should have been basically back at my home in West London by midday. And all sorts of things went wrong, and flights were incredibly delayed. And then eventually it was British Airways eventually took off. And then there was nowhere to land at Heathrow, and then nowhere to park at Heathrow. And then Terminal 5 was just carnage, frankly. It was absolutely ridiculous. So I was still in Heathrow Airport at 7 p.m., having had one of the worst travel days of my life. And British Airways, I have to say, were absolutely terrible that day. And there was just no information whatsoever about what was going on. And when you got to Heathrow, there was no information about whether bags were going to turn up. There were thousands of people waiting for bags, and there was no information as to whether your bag was ever going to show up. And they were trying to get people out of the baggage hall and get you to fill in a form, and they'll send your bag at some point in the future. I mean, it was just truly awful. And BA really let themselves down that day, and in my mind, let themselves down the most, because they sort of, at the end of the day, we're trying to absolve themselves of responsibility for the situation by saying that the baggage handling crew at Heathrow was a different company that was subcontracted and it was nothing to do with them, and which was terrible. But the good side of this story is I had booked a shopping delivery from Waitrose to turn up at my house on the Sunday afternoon when I would have been at home with my shopping for the week, for me and my children. And I use Waitrose every week, and they have been unbelievably good to me through the pandemic. And I'm glad to say never been to a supermarket for 2 years because Waitrose have been so fantastic. And I was still at Heathrow at 7 p.m. and they were supposed to deliver my shopping at 4. And they kept calling me every hour to check how I was doing so that they could come back to my house when I'd got home to give me my groceries, because they knew that I needed them for the week. And they literally could have just said, you've missed your slot, goodbye, book again. But the local Waitrose delivery person and the head office were unbelievably accommodating. And they eventually met me at my front door as my taxi pulled up from Heathrow, and met me at the door and brought my shopping in with me as I arrived home. And it was four and a half hours after it was due to be delivered. And they were phenomenal. And I will never forget that. And I will forever shop at Waitrose.
And that's that desire, because within those individuals as well, you know, that those people, be they in the head office, be they in the local depot, they've got that sense of customer. You know, what can we do to help this customer?
Completely. And they knew that I was having one of the worst days imaginable. Yeah. And it was, the whole situation was awful. And yeah, they just really went out of their way to make sure I got that food.
Yes. You and your children would not go hungry that night.
That's right.
Thank you. I'll keep imagining the hashtags that we might do with this related to Waitrose. My last question that I'd like to ask you is, if there was an opportunity for you to be reincarnated in the future and you could come back as any leader, any sector, who would you like to come back as and why?
Yeah. Now, who I'm going to say is, it could be controversial for many and possibly not as morally conscious as other choices I could make, but I would love to come back as Jeff Bezos.
Okay.
And not for his bank account, but because although that would be nice, but I have, since the very early days of Amazon, I have just always, always admired and respected him for his vision, for his unwavering commitment to customer excellence, for the way in which he created a unified organization around a common goal, and frankly, for the fact that his ambition has no bounds. Someone who created Amazon from data. I mean, the whole premise of the business is on, how do I take data to personalize offers and do phenomenal targeting to create targeted commercial opportunities for customers, through to, we will make no profit for years because we will reinvest every single pound we have in delivering the best experience out there, which is how Prime came around. And the delivery experience that we now all love and take for granted was spearheaded by them, to the fact that he makes his purpose in life has been to have the best customer experience in the galaxy, I think is how he quotes it, because he does genuinely believe that there will be a world on different planets, and, you know, he's going to help us get there too. I mean, I just, the man's vision and passion knows no limits, and he's achieved something, and some of how it's been done is controversial, I know, but what he's achieved in pursuit of true customer excellence, I think, is phenomenal. And because I'm a maths geek, the fact that it all came from data just sort of floats my boat.
I can see that. Yes, that sounds like a great fit. I've, you know, talked to people about that Prime business, of the fact that you could order something today and get it tomorrow. You know, it's something that organizations, you know, would just have laughed at before. And they had to change too in order to compete.
That's right.
It changed so many things about our customer expectations.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, it's truly changed everything, I think. And the fact that I could order some Amazon Fresh delivery now, and I know, because I do use it, it would be here within an hour, is amazing.
Claire, it's been fascinating talking to you. I loved how we began, actually, the whole concept of starting as a new CEO at Yale and how you organized your thinking around the what do we need to pay attention to here, through to the customer experience, which shines through in almost everything you say, of course, underpinned with great data. So thank you very, very much for your time today. It's been really, really great talking to you.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's been lovely talking to you as well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, anytime. Thank you so much for joining me today for this episode with Claire Miles on Leading for Business Excellence. If you'd like to know any more about our thought leadership content, you can find our podcasts, our Room for Improvement practitioner videos, our recordings of our webinars, and register for future events on PMI Live. You can see all of this on our website at www.pmi.co.uk. And of course, if you'd like to know any more about how to develop your career in business excellence and transform your organisation, please do drop us a line, team@pmi.co.uk. I'd love to hear from you.